The World and Everything in It is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Leah Geyer, and I'm from Lafayette, Indiana. I appreciate how World has kept my stay-at-home mom bubble and my quarantine bubble popped. I hope you enjoyed today's program.
Good morning. Pope Francis is pushing to legitimize same-sex relationships with an idea LGBT activists rejected 6 years ago.
And I think he who trying to care about every human being, he is the pro-life person.
That's ahead on Culture Friday. Plus, Megan Basham reviews a new documentary that Amazon originally didn't want on its platform.
Older Maid Ferguson pay the price for a racist murder that was neither racist nor a murder.
And our wordsmith, George Grant, with Wordplay.
It's Friday, October 23rd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Good morning.
Now the news with Kent Covington.
The president and his Democratic rival faced off for the final time last night before the election.
We welcome to the stage former Vice President Joe Biden and President Donald J. Trump.
The candidates met at Belmont University in Nashville for the second and final debate. And while both candidates lobbed personal attacks, they avoided the name-calling and constant crosstalk that marked the first debate. On the COVID-19 pandemic, Biden said President Trump's response has been reckless, and he called for a more measured approach to reopening the economy.
But you haven't ruled out more shutdowns.
Well, no, I'm not shutting down the name, but there are, look, they need standards. The standard is if you have a reproduction rate in a community that's above a certain level, everybody says, slow up.
The president countered that Biden is ignoring the unintended consequences of lockdowns.
People are losing their jobs. They're committing suicide. There's depression, alcohol, drugs at a level that nobody's ever seen before. We have to open our country. The cure cannot be worse than the problem itself.
On health care, Trump again said he still hopes to replace Obamacare while retaining its most popular provision.
Pre-existing conditions will always stay. What I would like to do is a much better health care, much better.
The former vice president said he would largely keep the current law in place while expanding the government's role.
What I'm going to do is pass Obamacare with a public option. Become Biden care. The public
election day is now just 11 days away, though more than 40 million Americans have already voted early. Biden holds an 8-point lead in an average of recent national polls. Trump is also trailing in most swing state surveys, but the Trump campaign is quick to note he trailed in the polls 4 years ago as well. Meantime, the U.S. intelligence community is working overtime to guard against foreign interference ahead of the election. On Thursday, Intel officials said Russian hackers have targeted the networks of dozens of U.S. state and local governments, stealing data from at least two servers. U.S. officials say it would be extremely difficult for hackers to alter vote tallies, but they have warned about other interference, including cyber attacks meant to impede the voting process. And on Wednesday, Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe told reporters
that we have identified that Iran and Russia have taken specific actions to influence public opinion relating to our elections.
He said Iran sent a flurry of fake emails aimed at hurting President Trump's re-election campaign. The threatening emails sent to Democratic voters claimed to be from far-right groups in the United States, that in an apparent effort to make it appear as though pro-Trump groups were terrorizing voters. At a news conference, FBI Director Christopher Wray assured the public,
"We are not going to tolerate foreign interference in our elections or any criminal activity that threatens the sanctity of your vote or undermines public confidence in the outcome of the election."
The two officials called out Iran and Russia for obtaining U.S. voter registration information. Wray said the United States will hold bad actors accountable and that the integrity of the vote remains sound. The number of Americans seeking jobless benefits fell last week to the lowest level in months. World's Kristen Flavin reports.
The Labor Department said 787,000 people filed claims last week. That figure was down from 842,000 the week before. And it's the lowest that number has been since pandemic shutdowns started crushing many businesses back in March. Unemployment claims fell in 39 states and rose in just 11. Thursday's report also said the number of people continuing to receive jobless aid tumbled by 1 million to 8.4 million. Economists welcomed the declines as evidence that the job market is continuing to recover, though many are concerned that a fall coronavirus surge could reverse some of those gains. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee advanced Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination to the full Senate on Thursday, that despite a Democratic boycott.
Mr. Chairman, the votes are 12 yeas, 10 no votes.
The nomination will be reported favorably to the floor with a unanimous vote.
Boycotting the judiciary panel session forced Republicans on the panel to change its rules to keep the confirmation on track. Those rules stated that at least two members of the minority party needed to be present to constitute a quorum for doing business. Democrats refused to show up in protest of the committee's vote on Barrett. They say it should have waited until after the presidential election and that the next president should fill the Supreme Court vacancy. The full Senate will vote on Barrett's nomination on Monday, and Republicans say they have the 50-plus votes needed to confirm her. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, the Pope's position on same-sex marriage, plus George Grant spell checks the Constitution. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Friday, the 23rd of October, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Pope Francis grabbed headlines this week after the release of a documentary film on his life. In it, he appears to refer to a position he took back in 2014 when he was Archbishop in Argentina. Back then, he called on the government to pass a civil union law for same-sex couples. In the documentary, the Pope is quoted saying, "They are children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or be made miserable over it. What we have to create is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered. I stood up for that."
At the Rome Film Festival, a Russian director said he understood the Pope to be calling for acceptance of homosexual people, but not going so far as to be changing church doctrine. Now, this is from a Reuters interview with the director.
I think that that's what is important, that he teaching us to stop labeling and stop framing people, allow every human being to be equal in this world.
One LGBT rights group in the United States applauded the Pope's remarks as, quoting here, "a fundamental step forward at a time when LGBTQ acceptance around the world and across religions is expanding and rightfully becoming the norm."
Well, it's Culture Friday, and so let's welcome John Stonestreet. John is president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mary. Good morning, Myrna.
Well, it's interesting to me that the buzz is about civil unions in 2014, because the very next year, in 2015, is when the Supreme Court reversed marriage laws here and firmly rejected half measures like civil unions. The court's Obergefell decision rooted same-sex marriage in dignity. In other words, that only an equal right to a marriage would pass legal muster from here on out. And LGBT groups absolutely reject civil unions. So it seems to me what we quoted here is exactly right. The applause is for what activist groups see as a fundamental step forward. John, what do you say?
Well, I think the history here is that Pope Francis, before he was Pope, used the idea of civil unions as a kind of a strategic measure in order to hold back same-sex marriage. And it was kind of seen as a third way or as a middle ground. And that's what civil unions have always been within this movement. It's been kind of a useful place to get to. It's kind of an incremental victory. But it's not a destination for LGBTQ rights groups, because what I mean by useful is not even that it's just an incremental step. It's something to achieve so that from there you can further claim bigotry or discrimination. Once civil unions were allowed, and civil unions, of course, intending even for heterosexual couples to grant the same sorts of property rights and legal kind of status for couples that aren't officially quote unquote married. Now you could say, well, what's the difference, right? It's everything but the name. So it must be out of animus or bigotry. And it certainly seemed like Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy bought arguments similar to that one and so on. So the stranger thing is, you know, why this is coming out now and kind of what's the point? I mean, civil unions, like you said, I mean, that's so 2014. Who's talked about civil unions even since 2014?
Well, John, yeah, I'm not an expert on Roman Catholic theology, but I do understand marriage for Catholics is sacramental. The Pope appears on a really treacherous road for any kind of long-held position the Church has had on the meaning of marriage. So do you think it's possible that the Pope could go further than he has?
I think that's the question. I think that's a question that is troubling for a lot of faithful Catholics. You know, there's that old joke, he's more Catholic than the Pope. There's a lot of Catholics more Catholic than the Pope at this moment after, you know, that statement yesterday, but not just that statement yesterday. I mean, this isn't a new concern with this particular pontiff. On one level, again, I want to go back to what we know from history, which is that, you know, when he was bishop in Argentina, this Pope used civil unions as a strategic measure. And that measure is based on reducing marriage down to only a sacrament. This is, in my mind, both a strength and a weakness here of this particular theological position. On the strength position, it actually, you know, treats this as something divinely instituted, which it of course is. It recognizes the inherent just blessedness of one image bearer and another image bearer coming together and for life, and that the actual outcome of that is going to be more image bearers. I mean, it's a remarkable thing that God has done in marriage. At the same time, we need to understand that marriage is God's sacramental gift to his creation, to all image bearers. You don't have to be a Christian to be married. This is a natural grace that God has given. What the Pope is doing is drawing this line to protect the church's ability to do church marriage. Well, the problem with that is then the church ceases to become the institution that it has always been, pointing to marriage as a gift from God to all people. And look, I'm not saying that every church has done that, but I think that's what marriage has always been. The state obviously is no longer in that business, proclaiming to the world what God had instituted, this institution that is both pre-state and pre-church. So if the state's out of doing that, we don't want the church being out of doing that. So as a strategic measure to protect our territory, I'm not a fan of the civil unions approach if it's tactical. If it's theological, well, of course not. I mean, that's just heretical. It's wrong. I mean, in the Catholic situation, calling this sacramental and then going against that, that would make this, in a sense, heretical. I don't think he's gone that far. I don't think we should think he's gone that far at this point, but that would be a huge mistake.
Well, I want to play one more piece of sound from the director of this documentary. Very interesting. Again, director Eugenie Afanyevsky casting the Pope's pro-LGBT statements as an important break from tradition.
Because the old traditions that are staying in a closet still, and I think he who trying to care about every human being, he is the pro-life person. So that's my statement.
Now, it's a little hard to make that out, but remember the old idea of being in the closet or being out of the closet? This is very old language around homosexuality. But his point is that the Pope's statements will help homosexuals come out of the closet in more conservative societies around the world. And even more interesting is this is how the director interprets pro-life, saying the Pope's encouraging words for the LGBT community is what makes him the pro-life person. Redefining the meaning of pro-life.
Well, you know, in a sense, I think he's right that it will encourage more folks to come out of the closet. And I think that's actually what's happened in this papacy on a couple levels. That said, the redefining of the term pro-life is just, obviously a ridiculous thing. It's Gnostic, actually. And here's what I mean by that. The problem with what we've done to marriage, what we've done to sexuality, is that we've removed any sort of created givenness to it from its definition, from what it actually is. And you actually hear this in churches, faithful churches as well, that don't go this far. They talk about marriage as being about companionship, marriage as being about mutual affection and commitment and love, everything but actually the bodies that God have given us coming together. When Jesus himself said that the two shall become one flesh, he did not say the two shall become just one. But we often in song and even in our modern liturgy and in the modern ways we talk about marriage, talk about it as if it's an emotional oneness. Well, if it's an emotional oneness, then and that's it, then there's no reason to keep it away from same-sex couples. And that allows somebody like this to use this ridiculous language. But if marriage actually itself has to do with the becoming of one flesh, and in the becoming of one flesh, kickstarting a process that requires two people, a male and a female, can never be done by two males or two females, and can never be done by anyone alone. And that is the physical process of procreation, which God instituted in order to allow his image bearers to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. Then to say it's pro-life is patently false on its head. Had we actually kept inherently throughout the early days of the sexual revolution, the fundamental ties between marriage and procreation as being more than just kind of a personal choice, or, hey, you know, hey, do you want to have kids? I'm not sure I want to have kids. Instead of the God-given created design of the institution itself, then it would be a lot easier to call this what it is, which is bogus, to say that an inherently sterile union could in any way be pro-life. An inherently sterile union doesn't produce any life whatsoever.
Well, John Stonestreet is president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Additional support comes from ChristianBook.com. Great gifts for everyone on your list at ChristianBook.com.
Well, a man in California recently made a wager with his wife. Mike Myler bet his bride, McKenna, $100 that she could not run a mile in less than 8 minutes. Well, he lost that bet big time. She ran it in 5 minutes and 25 seconds. Mike welcomed a breathless McKenna at the finish line.
I owe you $100. Yeah.
Well, her 5.5-minute, 1 mile time was impressive. According to Runner's World, the average female runner completes a mile in 10 minutes and 40 seconds. But her feat was impressive for another reason. 28-year-old McKenna was 9 months pregnant.
Wow.
She cleared it with her doctor before running. Mike later wrote, "Someone check the Guinness stats. My wife is an absolute champion." Well, good news, McKenna gave birth on Tuesday to a healthy baby girl.
What a mama.
It's the world and everything in it. It's Friday, October 23rd, and you're listening to World Radio, supported by listeners like you. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Myrna Brown. This summer, during the height of the Black Lives Matter protests, Amazon Prime released a series of billboards promising to amplify Black voices. It also added an Amplify-branded carousel of African-American films to its homepage. But there was one Black filmmaker the streaming giant wasn't interested in amplifying, at least until it faced a barrage of negative press. Shelby Still. Megan Basham, our movie reviewer, explains why.
Few screenwriters bring as impressive a resume to their project as Shelby Still. He's a former San Jose State Literature Professor and Hoover Institution Fellow at Stanford. Along with winning a National Book Critics Circle Award, a National Humanities Award, and a Writers Guild Award. He also won an Emmy for a documentary he co-wrote and produced for the PBS news program Frontline. Yet, when Steele and his son, director Eli Steele, submitted What Killed Michael Brown to Amazon's video on demand service, they received this reply. Unfortunately, we have found that your title doesn't meet Prime Video's content quality expectations and is not eligible for publishing on the service at this time. We will not be accepting resubmission of this title, and this decision may not be appealed. Well, anyone who views the film will get a quick idea what prompted such a terse reply.
Back then, I had no cynicism about justice. It was the word that had animated the civil rights movement more than any other. But after 3 years in East St. Louis, I no longer trusted the word. It hid more than it revealed and left too much room for corruption.
What Killed Michael Brown ostensibly focuses on the tragic case of a black teenager killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. But what it tells us about cultural myths, how big tech and big media help shape them and why, goes far beyond a single flashpoint. Steele calls these myths, such as the widespread inaccuracy that Brown had his hands up and said don't shoot just before he died, poetic truth. People buy into it, not because they've examined the evidence and found it credible, but because it aligns with narratives they already believe. It feels true.
This is a distortion of the actual truth that we use to sue for leverage and power in the world. It is a partisan version of reality, a storyline that we put forward to build our case. For example, that Michael Brown was executed is a poetic truth.
In Steele's example, the poetic truth is that systemic racism in the Ferguson Police Department created an environment that led to Brown's death. Obama administration Attorney General Eric Holder found no evidence Officer Darren Wilson was motivated by race. What he did find is that black people make up only 2/3 of Ferguson's population, yet represent 85% of traffic stops. Because of that, Holder concluded widespread bias permeated the police department. But Ferguson's mayor had another explanation based on more localized data.
Ferguson is a community that's integrated, but our surrounding neighboring communities are predominantly African-American, 90%, 95%.
Statistically, who do you think is driving down the roads?
People from all over this area come to Sam's because there is no grocery stores, no Walmarts, nothing in North St. Louis City, and every one of those people come to Ferguson to shop.
Steele says the danger in favoring poetic truth over objective truth, or put another way, broad theories over specific details, is that it always traps us into solving the wrong problems. He makes a host of arguments worthy of consideration, but for Christian viewers, the way Steele highlights how two different churches approach the nebulous subject of justice is especially valuable. The first joins forces with out-of-town activists.
If you get hurt, you get gas in your eyes. The word was, go to Greater St. Mark. If the protesters had not had a place, a home base, if you will, to come and to set up, the movement would not have lasted as long as it lasted.
The result, several local black leaders explain, was that violent protests in Ferguson went on longer than they otherwise might have. The city was torn apart. In the end, poor minorities who lived there faced destroyed infrastructure, crashing property values, and fewer resources. Steele puts it starkly.
Holder made Ferguson pay the price for a racist murder that was neither racist nor a murder.
The second church is in Chicago's South Side. Pastor Corey Brooks doesn't talk about theories or politics. Neither does a young former drug dealer who now works with him.
Me coming home, I was lost. I'm gonna be honest, I just did 11 years of feds. I got some good street skills, but me coming home, my friends take me to the church. And I'm like, who I meet? Like, you meeting the pastor? I'm like, I don't want to talk to no pastor, bro, I just came home. They're like, no, you have to talk to him because he run a neighborhood now. I'm like, he don't run no neighborhood that I'm in. So me seeing the pastor, he was like, okay, I know who you are, heard a lot about you, glad to see you home, but I'm new sheriff in town. do you really know what you did to your community? I'm like, no, what? He said, you tear your community down.
Brooks's ministry, teaching these young men tangible life skills that they go on to teach other young men, has created a domino effect of transformed lives. From a bird's eye view, it's all too easy to oversimplify every headline in favor of our neat ideologies to create our own poetic truth. But one of Steele's closing questions suggests the path out of focusing on forests and forgetting about trees.
I wonder what would have happened if Michael Brown had had the good fortune to meet Pastor Brooks.
It's our job to try and provide an answer to that question for some other Michael Brown. I'm Megan Basham.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Turn me around. Turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land.
Today is Friday, October 23rd. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Myrna Brown.
1 week from today, we will have our regular listener feedback segment. So if you have something you want to tell us, now's your chance. Now, we love getting emails and connecting with you on social media, but we can't play those messages on the program.
No, we can't. And that's why we especially like getting audio feedback from you. Now, you can do that in one of two ways. Call our feedback line at 202-709-9595, or even better, record a voice memo on your smartphone and just email it to us.
Simple enough. All right. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, Wordplay with George Grant.
When the text of the Constitution was first composed in 1787, it was written in the manner of the day. In other words, it was handwritten with a goose quill pen dipped in oak gall ink, inscribed on fine parchment. According to the supervising conservator at the National Archives in Washington, that original copy, with its distinctively classical calligraphy, was engrossed by Jacob Shallus, one of the official stenographers at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. Without the benefit of a spell checker app, Shallus inevitably made a few spelling mistakes. Mistakes that survive in the revered document to this day. To err is human, after all. For instance, in the list of signatories, the word Pennsylvania is misspelled with a single N in the first syllable. The state's correct spelling does appear in Article 1, Section 2, making the contradiction all the more noticeable and embarrassing. Shallus, after all, was from Pennsylvania, and he served as the clerk for its state assembly. There may have been some consolation for him, though, in the fact that it was apparently a common enough mistake in 18th century America. Even the inscription on the Liberty Bell immortalizes the misspelling. Another snafu Shallus made in the Constitution was a common enough one. It still is. In Article 1, Section 10, he spelled the word its with an apostrophe, as if the word were a contraction of it is, but the word is used as a possessive, and thus it should have been spelled without the apostrophe. On several occasions, Shallus spells the word choose with a U, rather than with the customary double O. To modern eyes, this looks like an obvious mistake. Actually, it was an acceptable alternate spelling in the 18th century. American spelling standards then, as now, were inconsistent at best. Not surprisingly, Shallus also used the British spelling for a number of words. Defense, spelled with a C rather than with an S, and control and labor, both spelled with OU diphthongs rather than with a single O. Again, though, these were acceptable alternate spellings in the former colonies. Pondering these lexicographic oddities reminded me of Mark Twain's delightful quip, "Anyone who can only think of one way to spell a word obviously lacks imagination." I'm George Grant.
Well, it takes many souls to put this program together each week, so we want to say a big thank you to Megan Basham, Paul Butler, Janie B. Cheney, Kent Covington, Nick Eicher, Kristen Flavin, Katie Galtney, George Grant, Kim Henderson, Anna Johansson.
Who's getting married tomorrow?
She is. Go, Anna. Lee Jones, Onize Ohikeri, Bonnie Pritchett, Sarah Schweinsberg, Cal Thomas, Whitney Williams, and Kyle Zemnick.
Our audio engineers, Johnny Franklin and Carl Peets, stay up late to get the program to you early. Paul Butler is executive producer, and Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief. And you, without you, none of this happens. So we thank you for your support. Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment." I hope you have a restful weekend.